All right, so we're diving into United States v. Bertram today, and this case is all about authenticating emails. Picture this: a healthcare fraud trial, high stakes, the prosecution's trying to prove a conspiracy using emails between these two defendants, Brian Wood and Brian Walters. Seems like a pretty standard scenario, right?
Yeah, pretty common these days.
But here's the catch. The witness they call to verify these emails, Chris Kaiser, she wasn't actually on any of the email chains.
Interesting. So how did they try to get around that?
Well, Kaiser, she was a billing contractor, so she'd worked with Wood and Walters before, knew their email styles, but wasn't copied on these specific messages. And that's where things get kind of tricky.
Yeah, this case really gets at how courts are trying to apply these, well, kind of old school evidence rules to the, I guess you could say, the Wild West of digital communication.
Exactly. It's a whole new world out there.
Yeah.
So the government, they want to use these emails as evidence. But could Kaiser's testimony actually get those emails admitted? I mean, she wasn't a direct recipient or sender.
Right. And that's where Federal Rule of Evidence 901b4 comes in. It allows for authentication based on what they call distinctive characteristics. Think of it this way. Email addresses, signature blocks, even just the way someone writes, they can all kind of act like a digital fingerprint.
Like a digital fingerprint. That's a good way to put it.
And get this. The court even pointed out that the defendants never even claimed the emails were fake, which definitely didn't help their case.
Okay, so they didn't deny the emails were real. They just didn't think Kaiser was the right person to verify them. What did the court say about that?
Well, in the end, the court sided with the government. They allowed Kaiser's testimony to authenticate the emails. Basically, they recognized that in today's world, it's just not practical to only allow senders or recipients to verify emails.
Makes sense.
Right. So they took this more flexible approach. They looked at the whole context. Kaiser knew Wood and Walters' email habits from working with them. And for the judge, that was enough to say, okay, let's let the jury decide on the authenticity here.
So the court was basically saying, we trust the jury to figure this out. But even if an email is authenticated, does that automatically mean everything in it is true?
That's a really important distinction. Authentication just means the email really came from who it says it did, not that the content is actually accurate. That's a whole other issue.
And in this case, the content of those emails was pretty important, right?
Yeah.
Because the government was trying to use them to prove this whole conspiracy between Wood and Walters.
Exactly. To deal with the truthfulness of the statements inside the emails, they used something called the co-conspirator exception. It allows statements made by a co-conspirator, like during a conspiracy, and to further that conspiracy, to be used as evidence.
Oh, I see. So the court had to analyze whether those emails fit that exception.
Yeah, they did. The court found enough evidence to suggest there was a conspiracy going on and that the emails were made to further it, so they were admissible as evidence.
So it sounds like this case is trying to walk this fine line between those traditional evidence rules and, well, the realities of how we communicate now.
Absolutely. And it's not just about balancing the old with the new. Think about the implications. United States v. Bertram basically sets a precedent for using third parties to authenticate emails, you know, as long as they can point to those digital fingerprints. It's a big deal for how we handle digital evidence going forward.
It definitely shakes things up a bit. But what about the potential downsides? Could this lead to, like, less reliable witnesses? Or even, I don't know, manipulation of digital evidence?
That's definitely a valid concern. Allowing third-party authentication could raise questions about how reliable the witnesses are, you know, and any biases they might have. How can we be sure they're really familiar enough with someone's digital style to authenticate an email?
Yeah, and how do we prevent people from taking advantage of this ruling? Like, could someone fabricate evidence to match those distinctive characteristics?
It's a real possibility. This ruling definitely raises questions about, well, how do we verify the expertise of those third-party witnesses? And how do we make sure the digital evidence itself is actually legitimate?
It seems like we need to, like, really think carefully about what this ruling means and figure out ways to prevent people from misusing it.
Absolutely. United States v. Bertram gives us a framework for authenticating digital evidence. But it also shows us that we need, you know, stronger standards and procedures to make sure it's reliable and prevent abuse.
So this case, it's definitely a game changer. It reminds us that the legal system has to constantly adapt to all this new technology. And even though this ruling might be a step in the right direction, we have to be aware of, like, the potential pitfalls.
Definitely. It's something to keep an eye on. It's pretty interesting to think about how much weight we give to, like, digital stuff, you know, in legal cases. We're so used to using emails and texts as evidence, but they can be like really easily taken out of context.
Oh yeah, definitely. Just because an email exists doesn't mean it tells the whole story, right? We need to like look beyond just the surface and consider everything.
Exactly. And United States v. Burcham, it kind of emphasizes that. Remember, the court didn't just rely on like Kaiser's knowledge of their email habits. They looked at billing records, you know, other communications, basically all the pieces to see if those emails fit into the whole conspiracy thing.
So it's more than just authenticating the emails themselves. It's about understanding what they mean in the bigger picture of the case.
Right. And that's where digital forensics comes in. Like, it's huge. It's not just about, is an email real? It's, you know, looking at the metadata, timestamps, IP addresses, all those little clues to get a better picture.
I've always thought that digital forensics stuff was so cool. It's like they're digital detectives or something, finding clues that, like, normal people wouldn't even know to look for.
It's true. They can, like, make or break a case. In Burcham, a digital forensics person could have looked at the email headers to see where it was sent from, you know, compared the writing style to other stuff from the defenders, even checked if it was manipulated.
They're like the Sherlock Holmes of the internet, using all that tech to find the truth hidden in our, like, phones and computers and stuff.
Totally. And the more we rely on all this digital communication, the more important these experts are going to be. Courts and juries need them to, like, understand all that evidence and make good decisions.
It's a field that's always changing too, right? I mean, new technologies, new ways to encrypt things, new ways to even communicate. It seems like the forensics people are always playing catch up.
It's a constant, I guess you could say, cat and mouse game. But that's what makes it so challenging and so important. They have a big role to play in making sure justice is served, especially now with, you know, everything being digital.
And it's not just about knowing all the tech stuff, right? They need to understand the law, too, and how all this digital evidence fits into it.
Oh, absolutely. They can't just find the technical details. They got to explain it to, like, judges and juries who might not be tech savvy.
Yeah.
They need to connect those digital dots to, you know, the legal arguments.
That's like a super specific skill set. And it makes me wonder, with technology changing so fast, how can the legal system even keep up? How can we make sure the rules of evidence still make sense with all this new tech?
That's the big question. It needs like a multi-pronged approach. We need to educate legal people, keep them up to date on, you know, the newest digital forensic stuff. We need better connections between law and tech to close that knowledge gap. And maybe most importantly, we need the legal system to be like always learning and adapting.
It's almost like we need a bridge between the world of law and the world of tech. A bridge that can handle all the, like, constant changes and new stuff coming out all the time.
Yeah, exactly. And that bridge, it needs to be built on collaboration, communication, and a shared goal of making sure justice is done in this, you know, digital age.
This case really shows how digital evidence is, like, changing the legal landscape. But as we've been talking about, there's this whole other side to it, the ethics. How do we balance meeting evidence with, you know, people's right to privacy when so much of our lives is online?
That's so important. Our devices have so much personal information, and we got to be really careful about how we access and use it in legal cases. We need clear rules, strong protections, and maybe even like a code of ethics just for digital evidence.
We can't just go digging through someone's whole online life because mm-hmm. we think we might find something bad, right?
Right. We got to respect people's privacy while still, you know, upholding justice. It's tricky, but it's what we got to do.
And with AI and machine learning becoming more common, those ethical questions about digital evidence are just going to get more complicated. How do we make sure those technologies are used fairly and responsibly?
That's a whole other deep dive. But it's a conversation we got to have now. As those technologies get, like, smarter, we need clear rules for how they're used in court, you know, dealing with bias, transparency, all that.
It's almost like we're entering this new frontier of digital evidence, where tech, law, and ethics are all kind of mixed together.
It's definitely uncharted territory, but it's also a really exciting time to be working in this field. We can, like, shape the future of digital evidence law and make sure it serves justice while protecting people's rights.
It's kind of crazy to think how much the legal system uses digital evidence now. Emails, text messages, social media. It's like key evidence in so many cases. But like we saw with United States v. Burcham, it also comes with a whole new set of problems.
Yeah, no doubt. It's we're really in uncharted territory here. And this case, it reminds us that digital evidence, it's not just about, you know, ones and zeros. It's about people, their lives, their reputations, their rights. We can't forget that.
We had to find that balance, right? Using digital evidence the right way, but making sure we're not, like, stepping on people's rights while we do it.
Absolutely. And that's where the, you know, the ethical stuff comes in. In a world where everything we do online is practically permanent, how do we make sure digital evidence is gathered and used responsibly? How do we prevent privacy violations and make sure people's rights are protected?
It's almost like we need like a whole new set of rules for the digital world, like a digital bill of rights or something.
I think we're already starting to see that happen. You know, courts are dealing with these issues, legal experts are debating them, and lawmakers are starting to address them.
But it's changing so fast. What's okay today might be totally outdated tomorrow.
Exactly. We got to be adaptable, proactive. We got to keep evaluating how we do things, refining our approach to keep up with all the new technology.
And it's not just the courts and, you know, the people making the laws. We as legal professionals, we have to educate ourselves about this stuff and advocate for like ethical and responsible ways of handling digital evidence.
Couldn't agree more. We got to be leading this conversation, shaping the future of digital evidence law, and making sure it serves justice while also protecting fundamental rights.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into United States v. Bertram, what's the like the main takeaway for everyone listening? What should they be thinking about as they, you know, deal with this whole new world of digital evidence?
I think the biggest thing is this. Digital evidence. It's powerful stuff, but it's not perfect. We got to be careful with it, look at it closely, and always consider it within the whole context of the case.
We can't just take digital evidence at face value. We need to ask, is it real? Is it reliable? Could it be biased? You know, we got to think critically about how it was collected, how it's being presented, and what it means for the people involved.
And we have to remember that every case, it's about real people with real lives. Digital evidence, it should be a tool for justice, not a way to, you know, violate someone's privacy or be unfair.
That's a great point. This deep dive has been really eye-opening. Mm. It reminds us that the law is always changing to keep up with the world. And as legal professionals, we got to stay informed, stay engaged, and keep working to make sure justice is served, especially in this digital age.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope this has been, you know, insightful and got you thinking. Keep exploring these issues, keep asking questions, and keep pushing the boundaries of legal knowledge.